Hi, I'm Charlotte Marchant, digital intern based at Bodmin Keep Army Museum.
I'm Joseph Quinn, digital intern at Helston's Museum of Cornish Life. Over the last 8 months, myself and Charlotte have shared with you how we have worked together to explore the diverse aspects of life in Cornwall during the Second World War, and to connect these stories to what's happening in people's lives today.
Just as we did for our previous BBC uploads, we're going to share with you some of the stories we have gathered. Stories of people, soldiers and civilians, locals and foreigners, enemies and friends. The stories of Cornwall during the Second World War. And in today's episode, we will be bidding you all farewell. As you know, Joseph, our time as digital interns at Bodmin Keep and the Museum of Cornish Life has come to a close. And as an appropriate sign-off, we're going to be paying a tribute to the fighting men who were based in Cornwall during the war. Both those who would have defended us from an enemy invasion and those who came to Cornwall to prepare for the invasion of Normandy to liberate the continent of Europe from Nazi oppression. So, what have you for us today, Joseph?
Well, given the day that's in it, and given that we are focusing on the themes of fighting men and invasion, I would like to concentrate on Cornwall's Home Guard.
Tell us more about it, Joe. Why was the Home Guard formed?
The Home Guard was really the brainchild of Winston Churchill and many other members of the wartime government. It was formed in May 1940, just as Hitler was attacking and routing the Allied forces in Western Europe. Now, at this time, there was a fear that Britain might be vulnerable to a German invasion, and that our armed forces needed bolstering. On the 14th of May 1940, the Secretary of War, Anthony Eden, made a BBC radio address to the nation, calling for men either above or below the age limit for military service, which was 18 to 41, to step forward to serve in what was then known as the Local Defence Volunteers. He told them, "You will not be paid, but you will have a uniform and you will be armed." They initially expected 500,000 in total. But in the first week alone, 250,000 tried to volunteer. And by July 1940, more than 1.5 million volunteers had stepped forward.
That's amazing. What an incredible number. How many men joined in Cornwall?
We don't have an exact number, Charlotte, but I have made an estimation of how many there were likely to have been. From my research in the National Archives in London, I've been able to establish how many there were in the regional command of which the Cornwall Home Guard was a part. The Home Guard was organised mainly at a county level throughout the country, and Cornwall was in the southwestern area of Southern Command. In the southwestern area, the numbers peaked at 56,000 volunteers in October 1940. There were 14 battalions of the Cornwall Home Guard, each one organized around the vicinity of the major county towns and urban centers, plus one independent company on the Scillies. Given the fact that a battalion typically held 1,000 men or more, we could conclude that 15,000 men or more would have joined the Cornwall Home Guard.
So every major town had its own battalion. So if we had been in the Home Guard, Joe, what
Okay.
battalions would we been in?
So, because I'm based in Helston, I would have been in the 8th Helston Battalion of the Cornwall Home Guard. And you, Charlotte, you would have been in the 13th Bodmin Battalion.
I don't think that's strictly true. I don't think they accepted women into the Home Guard, right?
Well, yeah, that is unfortunately true. The Home Guard was initially a male-only service. Women were actually banned by order in November 1941. However, there was an equivalent branch set up for women volunteers, and it was called the Women's Voluntary Services, and it had 50,000 volunteers. And they provided logistical support and other help to the Home Guardsmen. Eventually, however, in 1943, they did permit women to join the Home Guard, but by then the threat had long since receded.
But you mentioned a threat. Was there a possibility that Cornwall would have been invaded, and were our Home Guard prepared to meet the threat?
Yes, this is a tricky one. It's now generally accepted by historians that a German invasion of Britain would never really have been possible. However, if that threat had actually been real and the enemy had invaded around the Cornwall area, our volunteers might have found themselves very hard pressed indeed. The Cornwall Home Guard, which would have been small compared with other counties, was responsible for guarding the entire coast of Cornwall. Like, can you imagine? It's a very large coastline. And they would have required immediate reinforcements if the enemy had landed. They were initially quite poorly armed. Southwestern area had only 30,000 standard issue rifles, and 1,300 machine guns at their disposal. And that was enough to arm approximately two-thirds of the volunteers that they had at that particular time. Luckily for Cornwall and Devon, the number of hunting rifles and shotguns in private possession was higher than the national average, over 1,000 rifles and 6,000 shotguns. However, the standard issue rifles in their possession were definitely of inferior quality. They were mainly Canadian Ross rifles from the First World War, which, according to William Wallace, a Home Guardsman from St. Ives, they were notoriously inaccurate.
Were they well trained?
They were very well trained. They went on exercises and manoeuvres regularly, and the younger guardsmen had the benefit of having First World War veterans serving alongside them. And these were well-trained and seasoned combat veterans who were now much too old to serve in the regular armed forces. But they taught the whippersnappers everything they needed to learn to meet the enemy in battle, and ultimately brought a level of military discipline and professionalism to this force. In fact, when the younger members were eventually called up for service in the regular armed forces, they were pretty much good to go. You could say that British military prowess later in the war owed much to the high quality of training that was on offer to underage guardsmen in the Home Guard.
Right, well, it doesn't really sound much like the Dad's Army we're familiar with on the BBC. Do you have any funny stories in real life to share, Joe?
Yeah, I do have one, actually. William from St. Ives, whom I just mentioned, he worked in the camouflage netting factory in St. Ives by day and often did night duty with the Home Guard. Now, one night he was sleeping in a hammock in a pillbox overlooking the coast. And one of his fellow guardsmen just walked in from a patrol. And as he stepped into the room, the Ross rifle that he was holding accidentally discharged. It fired, sending a round ricocheting all around the room. Now, luckily, the round, after bouncing around the place, it buried itself in a bucket in the corner and nobody was killed or injured. It just goes to show you how completely and utterly useless those Ross rifles were. I mean, they seem more dangerous to ourselves than to the enemy.
So literally a bit like Dad's Army then.
Yep, a bit. That stupid boy. So what about you, Charlotte? I mean, who are we going to pay final tribute to in this episode before we finish up?
The Americans in Cornwall.
Okay, Charlotte. It's fairly common knowledge that the Americans came to Cornwall during the Second World War. But how and at what stage in the conflict did this actually happen?
Well, from 1943 and into the spring of 44, the Americans not only came, but they practically took over Cornwall and the southwest, with the vast majority of British troops moving out of the county eastwards. From Bude to Penzance, US soldiers had been turning up, according to the common phrase, over here, overpaid and oversexed, on what would be known as Bolero, the operation to find accommodation for all these men and their equipment. Tented camps sprung up overnight, large houses were taken over for officers' quarters, and along Cornish lanes, tanks and lorries were parked up under camouflage nets so not to be seen. It's common knowledge, of course, that the children loved it, being presented with chewing gum and chocolate at a time when rationing was at its height. And of course, the young woman enjoyed it too.
Yes, so I've heard. Say no more, Charlotte. I mean, did these GIs come from all over the United States?
So the 29th Infantry Division, also known as the Blue and Grey Division, based in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, made up the largest proportion of US Army soldiers here in Cornwall.
Yes, of course. Where in Cornwall were their headquarters located? Was it Tavistock, right?
Yeah, it was.
Do you have any personal accounts given by many 29th Infantry GIs that were based in the county?
Yes, quite a few, actually. How about the story of Richard Ford? He was assigned to the 29th Infantry Division, 115th Infantry Regiment in Landing, Florida, and from there went on to New York to cross the Atlantic with Britain as his destination. The ship which carried him and his fellow GIs was the Queen Elizabeth, the largest passenger liner ever built at the time. Travelling at an average speed of 26 knots, Ford claims the journey only lasted 4 days and four nights. He would disembark in Scotland, only to be loaded up into a train to travel into England. The food was bad enough that the Americans, not used to British rationing, of course, actually threw their meat pies out of the train's windows. Ford disembarked in Oxford before moving to Tidworth in late 1942 and eventually to Bodmin in early to mid 1943.
Very interesting to talking about the journey that Ford went in order underwent in order to get to Britain. Did Ford enjoy his time in Bodmin? I mean, what did he and his men get up to?
So Ford actually found that he was fascinated by the history in England, in particular Bodmin. He especially loved the ancient history on the moors, one of the key training grounds for 29th Division soldiers. So training was, of course, the division's main activity. But despite Ford's admiration for the ancient history on the moors, it would be misleading to suggest that all of the 2,000 men estimated to be billeted in Bodmin at the time considered their training on Bodmin Moor to be a pleasant experience. In fact, in an extract from 29 Let's Go, a book dedicated to the history of the unit during the Second World War, it suggested that no phase of training, either at home or abroad, holds a deeper and less cherished place in the memory of a 29th Division soldier. The moors were broad stretches of barren terrain, utterly desolate, covered with thick, spongy grass, occasional shrubs, prickly evergreen, and outcropping rock. In the winter, temperatures dropped to the low 30s. Raw coal filtered through the stoutest coat and the thickest blankets. The most expertly pitched tent was incapable of keeping its occupants dry. Water would ooze from the ground and rain would loosen and wash up the tent pegs.
Sounds pretty grim, to be honest. Didn't the men also undertake some of their training in Devon as well?
Yes. Ford was actually involved in the infamous practice landings at Slapton Sands, though it was only later that he discovered the extent of the casualties during Exercise Tiger, where an E-boat attack and a friendly fire incident resulted in the deaths of at least 749 American servicemen.
Yeah, that's such a tragic episode. It just shows the level of danger that these men were in, whether at home training or overseas in active battle, and just ultimately how complex the D-Day operation really was. But given the intensity of their training, may I ask what Ford and the other 29th GIs would have likely got up to in their spare time?
Well, in the soldiers' downtime during social hours, planned entertainment was always provided. Most famously, boxer Joe Lewis came to Bodmin to meet the troops, as well as comedian Bob Hope. In the centre of town in Bodmin, amongst other venues, there was the YMCA, a theatre, and numerous bars that were frequented by the Americans. But of course, this all came to a sudden end in June 1944, when the Cornish people woke up to find the US invasion over.
Yes. In other words, the troops were gone because D-Day was on. And where did the US soldiers based in Cornwall that took part in the invasion force, where did they leave from?
There were actually several embarkation points, including at Mount Edgecombe, the Fowell River and Tribar on the Helford. Though Ford and his men left from Plymouth, he recalls how odd it was taking off in broad daylight with local people watching as they took their equipment and disappeared off to France, left with the chilling uncertainty of whether they would successfully reach their respective beaches in Normandy alive.
Yeah, you just can't imagine it. The fear must have been immense. Did Ford make it, Charlotte? Did he survive?
Without going into too much detail of what happened when he reached Omaha Beach, yes, fortunately he did, but only by what Ford considered himself as sheer luck. Though soon after the landings, his war ended after being injured in an action at Percy in France. In an interview for the Library of Congress Veterans History Project, Ford says that ultimately, he cannot deny that he was changed by the war, a sentiment that I'm sure echoes with many other veterans.
Wow, that's quite sobering. But an extraordinary story, which highlights the remarkable bravery of US military personnel who sacrificed so much for our shared freedoms.
Yeah, and it really is so important to remember that our victory during the Second World War was due to the common Allied effort, often something that I think can get lost in the Britain alone narrative.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Charlotte. It's definitely a narrative that needs to be dispelled because Britain was anything but alone. Everybody played their part, willingly or not. People pulled together, from those at home to those fighting overseas. And we remember them. We remember them. We remember you and your sacrifices.
Yes, we do. And I suppose it now falls on me to thank you all for listening to our stories of Cornwall during the Second World War over the past 8 to 9 months. We very much appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. And we hope you've enjoyed it. And I'm actually personally going to really miss doing this, and I'm going to miss getting together with you once a month and, talking with Charlotte about all these wonderful stories, about really a perspective on Britain's war that very few people have ever heard about before, and something that's particularly close to the hearts of people in this county. It's been a real pleasure, and thank you very much for following us.
Yes, thank you. Goodbye.
Bye, take care, all the best.